Welcome, everyone, to episode number 112 of Underserved. Joining me in studio today is Michael Dane, head of data for Bowhead Specialty Insurance. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Michael, thank you so much for joining us today on Underserved.
Thank you, Andrew. It's great to be here.
So way back when, like, how did you first become interested in technology?
Well, the thing is, actually, I wasn't really a technologist at the beginning. And in fact, I don't really fit maybe the profile of the kind of tinkered in the garage with computers from childhood. I was an outrageous science fiction geek, so I loved the idea of technology. But, you know, for me, it was very conceptual.
I started out reading Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
That is great stuff, and I enjoyed that in college, too. I think of it more as comedy than science fiction, but, you know, I loved Arthur C. Clarke and Isaac Asimov and many of the other writers at that time who were writing about worlds unknown and how to get there, the technologies that would bring us there, all that kind of stuff. I really felt that by the time we reached the age we're in today, we would just be living in orbit and, you know, going to other planets and all this cool stuff would be completely real for us.
Flying cars all night.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned flying cars, because my older son, Orson, for him, that is the defining criterion for whether you're in the future. Flying cars, future. No flying cars, not future.
What about Philip K. Dick? Were you a fan of his stuff?
Yes, absolutely.
I can't believe how many movies they made out of all of his stories.
Well, of course, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep became Blade Runner.
One of my favorites.
Amazing.
So you're a sci-fi geek, go to college, major in English lit, but you're not that into it. What happens next?
Well, actually, I really loved English literature. It was wonderful in high school. When I got to college, I think follower syndrome caught up with me. I followed my older brother my whole life. He's 18 months older than me and lived in his shadow. And when I went to college, it was the same college. There was some part of me that realized something had to change. And after three semesters of just wasting time, I just decided it was time for me to go. I had a talk with my dad. I said, listen, I really appreciate the opportunity. I'm wasting your money here. I'm going to quit and see what's next.
And what was next?
One of the defining events of my life was next, because after working a few jobs, very interesting ones, including working with a conservator of metals at a arms and armor museum, various strange stuff, I earned a little money and I decided that I was going to take my Nikon camera and go to the UK with a backpack and a youth hostel card and a vague plan to photograph castles and stay there until I ran out of money. And this was really no plan at all, but it was my decision. It was my no plan. So I went, and various adventures ensued.
You had one that you mentioned on the pre-call where you end up having to slide down a rope to escape
yes,
a castle.
I did actually escape from a castle legitimately by sliding down a rope. So there's a castle on the coast of Scotland. So I roll up on this castle on my motorcycle and I go to the little guard shack, and the old guy there, he gives me the pamphlet about the castle, and I go inside, and the castle's set on a high rock, and that's a major feature. It's of course very defensible. You go up a ramp and there's a big gate, and you go through this huge gate, and so I'm inside this castle up on this high rock, and I sit down with my back to a stone well and I'm reading the pamphlet and I'm fully absorbed, which was typical of me, especially at that age. I would just disappear into written material and not come out for a long time. And when I do come back out, I look around and nobody's there. And I walk around and I find not only is no one there, but the gate is closed and locked. So I think to myself, okay, it's Saturday afternoon. This could be lunch or this could be the weekend. I'm not sure how long I might be here. So I start looking for a way out and I go around the base of the wall. And finally, I find a small wooden door that is being used to lift bricks for repair. And it's like a little hobbit door. I mean, it's a small door. And you go out through the wall to a pulley where this rope goes down, and it's a pretty disreputable looking rope. It's like covered in brick dust and it's all frayed and stuff, but it is a rope. I had my motorcycle gloves. I put them on. I reach out. I give it a good yank and it doesn't fall off. So I say, all right, here goes. And I reach out into space. I grab the rope and I slide down and boom, my feet hit the ground and I'm alive. And I think that was so cool. This was great. But the best part comes next, because now I'm down, I'm alive, but up at the top of the wall, that little door is still open, because that's one thing I couldn't really manage on the way down, was closing that little door behind me. So I go to the little guard shack where the old guy gave me the pamphlet, and I take out my notebook and I write him a note that says, "Dear sir, apologies, I was not able to close the small door on my way out by the rope. Next time you go to lunch, please take a good look around the castle. Sincerely yours, etc." And I pin the note to the little shack and then ride off on my motorcycle. I've always had a picture in my mind of that guy when he returned, whenever that was, reading that note and the look on his face.
He probably got rid of that thing immediately.
If he had any sense at all.
Not wanting his boss to find that one. So you're touring around, you're on this 125cc two-stroke East German, probably with terrible brakes. Like, what are your other stories from tooling around on that thing?
There were two cases that I can think of where that thing nearly killed me. And I had a blast. It was the best thing ever. I could go anywhere I wanted. And this was really the brilliant thing, not only about that motorcycle, but about that trip. And it was why it was so important. It was because every morning I got up and it was me and the bike and a full tank of gas and a map and nobody else. It's just up to me. It's my decision.
If anything went wrong, it's up to you to fix it.
That's absolutely right. And this is really why this whole trip for me was such a powerful experience and why I came back a very different person, able to do different things. So what happened on this bike? One thing was I went by ferry to this tiny island called Rasse. There are literally more sheep than people on this island. And there's one road that goes all the way around. And I had a blast riding around this island with cliffs that go down to the sea. I come around a corner and it turns out to be a kind of corner that kills motorcyclists. It's known as a reducing radius curve. It's one that gets sharper and sharper the deeper you get into it. And keep in mind, I had no idea what I was doing on a motorcycle. So this showed, and I found myself unable to control the corner, unable to keep the corner, and I had no choice but to get on the brake. And the brakes, as you said, were not so great. They were barely adequate. So I got on them for all I was worth, and I did stop, or we wouldn't be talking today, because I stopped with the arc of the wheel of my motorcycle actually out over the cliff, and little tiny pebbles, like in a movie, just tumbling down, down, down the cliff to splash into the sea far below. And thinking to myself, another 6 inches and it would have been
irretrievable.
Yes. Left youth hostel at 6 a.m., never seen again.
So what happens once the money runs out?
Once the money runs out, I go home. As I said, I came home a different person. I went back to college. I went to UMass Amherst. I finished my degree.
Go Minuteman.
Yes. It was a great experience. Among other things, I started tinkering with databases because I was looking at patterns in literature that I wanted to map. And so I started screwing around with that stuff. But later on, that would come back in other forms.
In the meantime, you were an English and Japanese major?
Yes. So I was foolish enough to minor in Japanese with my English major, which nobody does because it's much too hard. So usually you're either in Japanese as a major or you're not in it. But I was fascinated by the culture, and so I minored in the language.
And so where does that lead you for grad school?
Well, I ended up going to Johns Hopkins School for Advanced International Studies for a master's degree in economics. The thing about economics is that economics is one piece of it, and the other piece of it is your country of study. And you study the politics, the economics, the culture of that region. And since I had minored in Japanese, I thought, well, I'll just throw good money after bad and go all the way in. And that school was a tremendous experience. I've never academically worked so hard in my life. I would say Japanese country focus killed off probably at least a third, almost half of the students in my class.
I mean, you have to read and write kanji, right?
Yes. So you actually have to pass a level 3 foreign service exam in written and spoken Japanese, which means you functionally have to be able to read a newspaper and carry on a conversation. And to read a newspaper, you need at least 1500 kanji plus everything else. So it's significant. It's hard.
Do you end up traveling in Japan?
I did. I studied in Japan for a semester, and that was also an amazing experience. Climbing mountains, escaping from hordes of wasps, really entertaining experiences.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Maris Consulting Group, embracing the power of people in technology. For more information, visit mariscg.com. That's MARISCG.com.
And what happens once you get back?
When I get back, one of the things that happened that was also in the file under formative experiences, Andrew, was I interned on Capitol Hill. And at that time, I'm a Massachusetts boy. I grew up in Concord, Massachusetts. Teddy Kennedy was our senator. So I got a slot as an intern over the summer. The school had a good relationship with the office, and it was something that people did. What was different about it, I started out just opening constituent mail, the absolute most boring standard crap, right? You get a letter, you open it, you read it, you find out, you know, like what kind of standard thing it is, you match it up to the standard letter, you print the standard letter, you know, you stamp it with a signature and you send it out. But after about a week of this, I heard from across the hall that there were some other assignments that were available. Kennedy sat on the Senate Committee for Armed Services, and there was a lot of work to do. There were arms control negotiations, and I volunteered. I said, you know, I can do some research. And I would say, you know, we had the Congressional Research Service available. We had all this documentation. I hustled my ass off. I don't think I walked a step the whole time I was in that office. And I really tore into the assignments that they gave me so hard. And I had some knowledge in that area of strategic issues in Southeast Asia that within a couple of weeks, I was functionally serving as a full-time staffer for the Armed Services Committee. I wrote briefings on arms control. I read Ollie North's diaries so that, you know, I could help write briefings on vetting candidates for State Department ambassador positions. Like all this crazy stuff. It was a fantastic experience, but it really taught me the value of hustle. It's important. I mean, you can know what to do, but if you don't do it hard, sometimes it just doesn't matter.
But in 1994, your tech story begins working alongside your brother?
Yes, that's right. So in the early 90s, my brother, Abe Dane, who was then working as the science and technology editor for Popular Mechanics magazine, he won a fellowship with MIT for the Knight Foundation to go and learn about technology as a journalist. And he learned about the internet. And he came home at Thanksgiving, we're all gathered, and he said, hey, Mike, you know, I've been learning about this stuff. We're going to make a website for the magazine. I said, well, what's that? And he showed me, and I said, well, that's really interesting. And he said, well, do you want to help? And I said, sure, why not? At that time, I was between jobs for complicated reasons. And I said, what the hell? Let's do it. So I went into New York and we worked on this thing. And it was an amazing experience because back then, you know, nobody knew what a URL was. Nobody knew any of this stuff. It was the NCSA Mosaic browser and, you know, Netscape was the new thing. So there were all, because it's Popular Mechanics, and at that time, believe it or not, that was a technology forward magazine. We wanted it to be good. We wanted all this cool stuff. So we go to the technology guys and they say, how long do you have? 10 weeks. It's a story. It's going to be on the cover. You can't do that. So we said, okay. And then we went back and did it. So this was one of my first cases of learning something that I've learned over and over again since then in technology, which is it is valuable to go to the expert. But when they tell you you can't do what you want, don't listen to them.
Or they tell you it's impossible or it can't be done on that schedule.
Yes, absolutely. So we did it and it was a big success. It was on the cover of the magazine. We pulled it off. You know, it's a magazine that's published by Hearst Publishing. And Hearst Publishing, they said, hey, we have this new media division in this big fancy office over at Columbus Circle that's burning money trying to figure out what new media is. So you guys just did something that they can't manage to do on a story budget in a cubicle with one shared computer. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to put you kids in charge of that thing and see what happens. And they did. They made my brother the editorial lead for that thing, and I became the director of production for Hearst New Media with zero technical credentials.
But you knew the value of hustle. You discovered that the secretary had a clock with an alarm that went off at midnight. Why?
The way you discover that is by being there at midnight in the office. And every midnight, there was a loud beeping sound that came from one of the secretary's offices, her desk, and we discovered she had at some point set her alarm to midnight. And you would never find that out if you were a sane person, but that was our quitting whistle every night. We were always there. One of the great moments that I remember, Andrew, from that experience was when it really sank home to us. I mean, we worked hard and we were developing a whole way to translate printed media into internet content. And that wasn't just mechanical. There was a mechanical part of it, which was my job of building templates and building conversion scripts and, you know, building workflows to take the material from the published file formats into website content. But there was also an editorial aspect because the same stuff didn't work on both medium. And becoming real students and scientists of analyzing web server log, you know, this was the early days, like really finding out what browsers are they using? Where do they go? What are their paths? You know, what's the user experience? Really pioneering and beginning that whole science of understanding what your user needs. But when we realized what had really happened to us, I do remember one very silly scene where there was this conference room decorated in the finest, we want people to think high tech when they walk into this office style. And it had a huge marble conference table, an oval, and it looked right out on Columbus Circle. And I remember my brother and I actually getting up on that table and dancing when nobody else was there. Just a dance of, we did it, we've arrived, we're not sure where we are, but this seems really cool.
So what's the last chapter there?
So things got complicated. I think ultimately politics caught up with us. We had a lot of great successes. We brought all of the big magazines online, but ultimately we ended up out. And I think that the people who probably should have been there by age and seniority and all that stuff eventually managed to bring back reality and throw us out. Corporations have a way of doing this.
But on your way out the door, you managed to sell a process patent?
So that comes later, actually, as part of what my brother and I did next. So the next and last chapter of the brothers working together technology story comes with our little startup called ePrints, in which we provided an online shopping experience for photographs from weddings or other events. And, you know, we tried hard. It was a good idea. It was before its time. Photography wasn't digital yet. You had to scan everything. But, you know, we signed up hundreds of photographers. We processed thousands of events. I built all the technology, and I did write a process patent, which was later acquired by Kodak. And after that, our paths really separated. My brother still has a very interesting technology startup called Tizra, and I went in at the ground floor with a company called GTEC, which was a lottery technology company, and later became, by mergers, IGT, which is now the world's largest lottery system integrator.
So you hit GTEC. What are you doing there first?
So what I was doing there first was really establishing myself as a technologist. I went in as a junior engineer, entirely self-taught. And what I delighted in doing there, I made some good friends there, was using very low-cost technology, a lot of .NET and Microsoft Stack stuff, to build business applications that were very cheap and fast to build and functionally replaced very expensive stuff that the enterprise wanted to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on. And that was a lot of fun because we would build some, that, you know, the company would say, we want to buy a system to handle trouble tickets. And it's this huge, you know, piece of a CRM system, and it'll cost, you know, $1.5 million or whatever. And we'd say, well, like, why would you do that? You know, wait right there. We'll be right back with something that does exactly that. And a week and a half later, we'd come back to them, and then we'd build something something, and that thing would handle literally tens of thousands of tickets and be in service for over a decade. So that was fun, but I continued the lesson of hustle. So I remember I taught myself to be an object-oriented programmer. Why? Because I said, this application really calls for object-oriented design. The tools are object-oriented. I have to do it, but I don't know how to do that. So I got a book and I put in a couple of 90-hour weeks and I became an object-oriented programmer. I'm probably still not a very good one, but you know, that was the way I operated in that environment. And what it enabled me to do was to become capable enough in areas, especially data, where I worked my way into the production side of the house. And what happened was I basically, without knowing it, built a small data warehouse completely from scratch. All the processing, all the stored procedures, everything. Because we needed to analyze slot machine data. We needed to understand it, what people were doing, what games were successful, what attributes were made them successful. And this caught the attention of the people who actually delivered the system. And the thing about the lottery industry is that it's very long contracts and big money. And so winning those contracts is super important. Once you get in the door, you're in for 12 to 15 years on these huge contracts. So one of the things that generally that company was bad at was data. And nobody really cared because they'd never seen data win a contract before. But I got a hold of the data warehouse team and I realized that we actually had a huge wealth of data that could unlock answers to a lot of questions that I knew that the people running lotteries, the departments of revenue in the different states would want to know. So we put together a system and a demo. And this contract for the Maryland State Lottery came up. Now, Maryland was a contract where we were not supposed to win. It was a colossal long shot, which is probably why they let me talk to these guys, right? Because I was just the newbie. So I got the opportunity to present my team's BI solution to the entire Maryland Department of Revenue, all the big shots. And we killed it. We answered questions they didn't know they had, and we won the contract. Now, I don't know whether we can really take credit for that or not. But I know we weren't expected to win. And I know that we were told that that demo had made a big impression on those people. The result of that was they said, okay, kid, you seem to know what you're doing. We're going to put you in charge of running that whole delivery. So now I'm going from new guy to data warehouse guy to lottery system delivery lead. And that required that I learn a whole bunch of other stuff, because that means terminals, wide area network, central processing systems. You're basically talking about a distributed network of terminals and a centralized processing system that generates hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue.
It has to be hardened, because I imagine everyone's attacking it.
Absolutely. It has to be very secure. That was fun. So I ran that, and one thing leads to another. And before I know it, now I'm in Cordova, Argentina, delivering a lottery system. I'm in Stockholm, Sweden, delivering a BI solution for that lottery system. I'm all over the place doing all this stuff. And it was a tremendous experience. And I think that one day I woke up in Argentina realizing that I was giving a presentation in Spanish to the Cordova Provincial Lottery Department on our network and database system. And I thought, wow, how did I get here?
Es muy duro.
Pero muy importante.
Sí. Mucho dinero.
Hey, sport. How was school today?
It was okay, Dad. How was work?
Actually, I had a rough day. Leading an engineering team is hard. I mean, I have to ship new software, meet deadlines, and tackle new projects while keeping my team focused on the day-to-day. It's hard to keep up.
Jeepers, Dad. Why don't you call Maris? They're the staffing firm with the best technical resources around. They helped Billy's dad. He used to be stressed out like you. He was missing deadlines, his team was overworked, and a bunch of folks left the company because it was too stressful. But then he called Maris. And they put resources to work right away. He hit all his deadlines and freed up his team to do other work. His boss was so happy that Billy's dad got some extra time off.
Time off? Wow. What did he do with that?
He spent it with Billy.
That's a swell idea, son. I'll call Maris today. Now, you go wash up for supper.
Speaking of mucho dinero, you also did an implementation of Rhode Island Casino, and I was kind of blown away by how much money was going through the fire hose there.
Yeah, the Rhode Island system was very interesting because the thing about the Twin River Casino in Rhode Island, run by the Rhode Island State Lottery, is that it's a 24/7 operation. And back then, it was generating about $500 million in cash played a month. So that breaks down to somewhere around $750,000 an hour, about $17 million a day. So if they're down, they really care. There's a high sense of urgency. So our mission was to replace that lottery system, the central processing system and the network, with a completely new one. So I want you to think about this. You know the old metaphor of pulling the tablecloth out from under all of the china without breaking anything. Now imagine that you had to pull that tablecloth out and put a new tablecloth in somehow magically without breaking anything. That's really what we're trying to accomplish here. And so these central systems, they were multiplexed, or as we call it, n-plexed, through a broadcast system of transaction logs that was a proprietary system. And one of the important strategies that I developed as part of the approach to this was intentional failure. So what you do when you switch over the system is you have to redirect the network to the new system. And there are many mysteries in networking. Sometimes things just don't go as expected. And we couldn't test all of those things because the thing about many systems is it's really impossible to construct a completely faithful test environment. So you're left with testing as much as you can, but realizing that some things when you go into production just might fail and you don't know why. So the approach that I came up with was, I said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to swing the network to the new system. We're going to pick the deadest time on the floor that we possibly can. We're going to have people on the floor who will perform transactions and tell us by radio immediately the results. And we are intending to switch the network for 1 hour and switch it back. We're not going to go and see if it works. We're going to assume it will fail. And then we will plan to switch back so that the fail back is completely planned part of the exercise. There will be no chaos. There will be no decision points. This will be entirely part of the plan.
That sounds like a implementation head fake.
Yes, in a way, right. If you think of the bugs as the opponents, this was absolutely a head fake. And it worked extremely well because what happened was, of course, it did fail. We learned what we needed to learn. We got out. We took the time to study what had gone wrong. And then we were able to implement very smoothly. Like, that project was a great success. Many of the problems that we ended up solving are all credit to the brilliant engineers that we had working on that team. But I was able to learn certain approaches to the problem to line those people up to be successful.
And when you saw public cloud starting to become big, what did you decide to do about that at IGT?
So the thing about lottery business is that it's based on these long contracts. And part of why is because it's a kind of an old school big iron rack system type of environment. So it's hard to change system. But I realized when public cloud became a thing in the early 20 teens that this would not remain the case forever. It's way too easy to see how that won't remain the case, right? Because you can create environments so quickly. You can create environments through code. We used to struggle to stress test our systems because to buy a new system was so expensive that the window that you had to do stress test on it was always very small and shrinking because you can't sit on a system that expensive. You have to ship it. So if you look at public cloud and you say, like, I can just have infrastructure as code and I can just push a button and deploy a gigantic system and I can stress test the hell out of it, and then I can push another button and have it disappear and stop costing me money, this is not very hard to figure out why this is a good idea. When you run 15-year contract and by the time you get into year 10, you have systems that are end of life, software that's end of life, and now you got to figure out how to manage your patching. If you have a cloud environment, a public cloud environment, where that's all somebody else's problem, that's all AWS's problem or Azure's problem or Google's problem, that's a great place to be, right? So I looked at this and I said, we need to be doing public cloud. And at that time, we were an IBM shop. All of the players were very competitive. They were very hot to get in. I was able to kind of snap my fingers and get all these big providers in and run all these POCs and have them, you know, give us all these great presentations. So we did that. We learned a lot very fast. And We ran very structured POCs, and we ended up building some data products in AWS that were very successful.
You worked with a team from Poland at that time?
Yes. So I was fortunate to have a really great team of data engineers in Warsaw. I had also teams in Chennai and Hyderabad in India, and some resources in the US. I learned, by the way, a lot about running remote teams during that time, long before the word COVID had been spoken. So that helped me later on as well. But that Warsaw team, they were great. I got them all this free training from AWS when we ended up ultimately selecting AWS, and they overnight became big data engineers. Now, this was another kind of a problem because they also doubled their value. And at that time, they were probably underpaid to the market. Not probably, I know they were. So I had the great pleasure of saying goodbye to all my best engineers and congratulating them on their fancy new big data job. And as it happened, the same thing happened to me within about a year. And I left then for a cloud data architect position for substantially more money than I was making as a director in the lottery industry.
And that was to Homesite Insurance?
That's right. That's right.
Now, for folks who don't know Homesite, because they're kind of a, you know, back end to a lot of other things, like, can you explain the company?
Yeah, Homesite is a fascinating business model, and that was a great place to land. I was very fortunate to work with a VP whose job was really just to build modern data platform for this Homesite Insurance. What Homesite does is they do all online insurance sales. That's 100% their focus. And they do it for major partners. They do it for people like Progressive, people like Geico, people who spend billions of dollars advertising and getting customers in the front door, which now Homesite doesn't have to, because they provide private label backend experiences to bundle other insurance products and give the customer the opportunity to purchase those products. So it's a tremendous stream of business and customers without having to spend all the money and build the image.
That reminds me of Monster and all their hundreds of private labels back in the day. What sort of work were you doing there? Like, is this more AWS cloud type stuff?
Well, so the fun thing was that part of the reason I took this job is because I had just finished building a really fun serverless data platform in AWS as part of this kind of commando project for IGT. And even though there was kind of a mismatch in the position, and this was a kind of a lesson to me too, right, that I was sitting as a director of BI and IGT, and the position when it came across my desk was for a cloud data architect, individual contributor position. And I thought, that doesn't seem like a match. But it came from actually a recruiter that I had a great relationship with. And so I took a deeper look at it and I read what they really wanted this person to do. And I said, not only do I know exactly why they need to do this, but I know exactly what they need to do and how to do it because I just did it. So I said, yeah, sure, I'll talk to these guys. And I had a series of great interviews. I interviewed with a really brilliant data scientist who was there at that time. And I ended up going in there and landing as this, you know, individual contributor, cloud data architect in this wonderful position with this really almost carte blanche to build greenfield modern data platform. So I used the principles that I had learned and I took it to the next level of, you know, you want to be platform native, you want to be serverless, you want to be event driven. Because the thing is, Andrew, like all along the way, I had learned through building data warehouse in a old style rack system age on IBM systems, all the things not to do and all the ways that they kill teams and kill technology, and things like scheduled job, things like static source to target mapping, all these things that make it so that systems are resistant to change. And this has a terrible effect on the technology, the technologists, and the business, because you get stuck and you can't move. The data can't move, it can't flex, and so the business can't move and can't do what it wants. So I designed from the beginning systems that are configuration-driven, platform-native, event-driven. As soon as data arrives, they do the stuff. They do not wait for the clock to tick. All the schemas dynamically managed, right? So when the system that is generating the data changes, because guess what? They do. inevitably, the systems generating data change, and you want them to be free to change because that's the business generating the data. It has to be free to move to the market. When that data changes, you don't want to have to refactor all your pipelines and rebuild all your stuff, or worse yet, tell the business, hey, you got to delay that release. You can't do that stuff because you're going to break all our shit, right? You have to be able to say to them, don't worry, do what you need to do. The data platform will adapt.
And you mentioned being event-driven and having stuff happen as soon as data arrives, but you also did some work on figuring out something that's more difficult to trigger when something hasn't happened in a while.
So one of the things that right around 2019, HomeSight was launching a new experience. And I looked at it and I looked at what my team had started to build out in terms of the framework-oriented platform. And I realized with the tools that we had in AWS, hey, we can do this in real time. Now, the business had not asked for real-time data. We went and told them, hey, you can have this. What do you think? And they were like, oh my God, that would be amazing, which taught me something interesting too about requirements, right? That it is important to listen to the business. It's critical. The business should lead. But also sometimes technologists have a duty to tell the business what is possible because they will not always know. So we built a real-time platform. And this also, I had the privilege to work with another brilliant engineer. And this is a really fun story because it helps me understand how sometimes all of these things that I've learned come together about how to talk to people, how to communicate the importance of work, how to communicate the excitement of work. I went that year to reInvent, the huge AWS party that, you know, people know, you know, who have ever worked with AWS. I was in a conversation with our AWS consulting team. And I mentioned that I wanted to do real-time data. And they introduced me to this engineer and they said, here's a guy who knows about Kinesis and maybe you should talk to him. And so I got in this really very enthusiastic and super intense conversation about what the potential was. What is HomeSight's business model? Why would this accelerate it? Why is this important and interesting? What could we do? And by the end of the conversation, he was so excited, he went back to his managers and said, is there some way that I can get out of my assignment that I'm in now and go work for Mike at HomeSight? And it happened. And he ended up working with me for about almost 2 years. And it was a fantastic relationship, but all the way around to what you actually asked me about, Andrew, which is, how do you detect when something stops happening? So not only did we have to manage the real-time data coming off the platform and do it in a way where the schema was dynamically managed, which we did, but we also had to be able to determine when the user stopped interacting with the platform. Because when somebody stops interacting with the platform, as any marketing person knows, that's when you want to call them back.
Now, back in the 90s, I would have written an aging job to like figure out like when the last thing happened.
Yeah, and that's basically it. It's all about like time to live. It's all about knowing how old the last transaction is. But on a real-time pipeline, that's quite challenging. So having things trigger data that comes in, be recognized by a pattern and trigger an event is very straightforward nowadays. But noticing when an ID or some identifier stops arriving on a stream and stopped arriving 20 minutes ago and doing that efficiently in a high-volume stream is not that easy. It turns out that Apache Flink does this really well, and it turns out that you can host an Apache Flink application on top of Kinesis. So AWS has something called Kinesis Data Analytics for Java Applications, and you know it's evolved over the years, but we identified that as a solution, and we beat the heck out of it. We really worked it hard. We stress tested it. We found a lot of leaks and gaps and rough edges. We worked with AWS to fix those and understand them. And ultimately, we put in production systems that have been reliably functioning for years.
Now, I know you haven't started there yet, but what are you looking forward to doing at Bowhead Specialty Insurance?
this is going to be so fun, Andrew, because as much as I've enjoyed all my time at Homesite and later American Family, which is the parent company, and my growth in that environment, it's a big company. It has multiple operating companies. It's doing its best to scale and centralize, and that's great. But the feeling of building Greenfield in an environment in which I can have a big impact, that's really what I'm looking for. And Bowhead is a wonderful company. It's run by super smart insurance people. It's a small company, but they're doing great things, but they really need a data platform that works for them. So it's an opportunity to go and use all the stuff that I've learned to really listen hard to those smart insurance people, understand what they need the data to do for them, and build a data platform that really accelerates that business.
So when you're not working, you have number of hobbies, but one that I figured I'd touch back on since we began with it is, how did the motorcycling story continue later in life?
Yeah, well, so I had all these scrapes with, you know, cliffs and sheep and, on my motorcycle in the UK. And I came back, and for a couple of years, I didn't have a bike, but I couldn't resist. And so I ended up buying a Suzuki twin called a V-Strom. And I owned a number of bikes over the years. I bought a very fast Ducati, which I had a kind of troubled relationship with. And I do like speed, it turns out. I like going very fast. It's always been a problem of mine.
That's not a problem. That's a feature.
It depends on who you talk to. I did crash that Ducati a couple of times. And through a combination of dressing to crash and just dumb luck. Anyway, I walked away both times. But the second time I crashed, I realized that it was my fault. And that as fast as I could go and as much fun as I had, I really just didn't know how to ride a motorcycle very well. I felt like it was possible to do it better. And I was talking to friends who rode, and one guy recommended this motorcycling school to me. It was a racing school, and it was called the California Superbike School. Wonderful experience, and it was a two-day, 100% in experience where you just all day long, you would ride, you would go in a little classroom, you would be taught a specific technique, you would just go out on a track and put that technique into practice and come back. And, you know, they were feeding us salt tablets and just wearing us out on the track. And I learned so much. One interesting thing is they taped over the speedometers on the bikes because they didn't want you to know how fast you were going by the numbers. They wanted you to judge everything for yourself just from how it felt. But it felt like we were going about 1,000,000 miles an hour. And I learned that there are secrets to riding a motorcycle. There are secrets to braking and turning that are not intuitive. And when I learned those secrets, I could go so much faster, but more importantly, I could always be very comfortably inside of my envelope of control, that my envelope of control expanded hugely so that if I encountered something like, let's say, a reducing radius corner on some weird island in Scotland, I would just know that I have to put my weight down inside the bike, stand the bike up, and the bike will magically turn sharper, and I will not go off the cliff. So that was a phenomenal experience, and it really taught me the value of being willing to take the crash, being willing to make the attempt, have the failure, but then be smart enough to really get myself into an environment where I could expand my envelope of control.
Well, that sounds a lot like your approach to the migration, where you would know you were going to crash, dress to crash,
yes,
and then roll it back just like you planned.
100%.
Any charities or causes that you're passionate about?
Yes, there are two things that I'm really passionate about. The first one I'll mention, that most importantly, my wife suffers from something called ME/CFS. It is myelinencephalitis chronic fatigue syndrome. And this is a disease that actually affects millions of people. It has come more into prominence because it is associated with long COVID. But here's what it does. Imagine that you were put into battery saver mode. Your screen dims, all functions are reduced, and then you just can't come out again. it seems to be something that affects the cellular metabolism. And so your energy to do anything is dramatically reduced. And it's tremendously frustrating. The most extreme cases, people lie in bed without even the energy to talk. In my wife's case, when she was really bad, she would have to save up her energy for 2 or 3 days to have enough energy to take a shower. Now she's fortunately much better, but it's still, she doesn't function at 100%. You know, it's always in a spectrum between 40% and 70%. So this is a cause that we care deeply about.
And you mentioned there was a second as well?
The second is one of the things that we didn't mention when it came to hobbies. At one time, I was a very avid sports shooter. I invested a lot of energy in being a target pistol shooter, and I was pretty good at it. I had some success.
If by success you mean state champion in pistols in Connecticut in 2000 and 2001?
Those were some of them, yes. But I spent a long time away from guns. I came back to it. I'm now a father. I have 2 boys and also a wonderful stepdaughter. And my perspective has changed very dramatically. And I now make a regular donation to Sandy Hook Promise. I have a very strong belief that we have a duty to make our environment safe from gun violence for children.
Amen to that. So, Michael, thank you very much for joining us today and sharing your experiences with listeners of Underserved.
Thank you so much, Andrew. It's been a great pleasure.
And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.